Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Afghanistan's security forces are exposed as corrupt, abusive and murderous in a new investigative film. We ask how secure the handover to national forces will be in the light of this evidence.
I can absolutely see southern Pashtuns in Afghanistan welcoming a return of the Taliban, because they will see them as the good and just Muslims who don't tax them at checkpoints, don't rob them, don't kidnap them, don't abduct and rape their children. So the civil war has already started.
That was Ben Anderson, and defence correspondent Robert Fox will also join us to give us his view. When your economy is edging towards the gutter, time to welcome in the foreigners. We sit down with Portugal's Secretary of State for Tourism.
We host so many tourists that we want to go to the second stage. Not only you come for tourism, but you also come to buy a home.
We'll see how that goes. Plus...
Thank you, Academy. 谢谢. Namaste.
We'll find out why the Oscars have been absolutely great for absolutely everybody. All that plus a business roundup with Bloomberg's Pim Fox, a new book on Hugo Chavez, and a little bit of music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So, as ever, rather a lot to pack in over the next hour. But before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Initial exit polls show Italy centre-left taking a strong lead in the country's lower house of parliament, with one analyst saying a poor result by outgoing Prime Minister Mario Monti is the biggest surprise of the day. Projections from an earlier vote showed Silvio Berlusconi centre-right, slightly ahead in the Senate, a result that could cause deep government instability if confirmed. Professor James Walston of the American University of Rome said the polls were not yielding any great shocks.
The Italians haven't given us any huge surprises. The big surprise might have been if Grillo had went well over 20%. The big surprise would have been if the PDL had crashed. That hasn't happened. Or if Berlusconi had gone up. That wasn't expected because Berlusconi had been promising too much. What is surprising is how badly Monti has done, and this will certainly have effects on the markets. It will certainly have effects on the new government, whether he is in it or not.
Agriculture ministers from across the EU have been meeting in Brussels to discuss meat labelling as the horsemeat scandal continues to grow across the continent. Last month, horsemeat was identified in Irish beef burgers, and since then many more products have been withdrawn after testing positive for horse. Sweden's IKEA halted sales of its trademark Swedish meatballs in 13 European countries today after tests in the Czech Republic showed the product contained horsemeat. The Vatican has announced that Pope Benedict has changed Catholic Church law to allow a successor to be elected early. With just 4 days left before he steps down, the Pope accepted the resignation of Britain's only cardinal-elector, Keith O'Brien, after allegations that he behaved inappropriately with other priests. The new US Secretary of State John Kerry has said that continued violence in Syria represented further evidence that it's time for Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad to relinquish his post. The top US diplomat was speaking at a news conference after meeting UK Foreign Secretary William Hague in London, the first stop on a nine-nation, 11-day trip that will also take him to Berlin, Paris, Rome, Ankara, Cairo, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi and Doha. Mr. Kerry was clear on the US stance on Iran.
And Iran, with a nuclear weapon in that region, and given all that has happened, is simply unacceptable. And we have stated that they will not obtain a nuclear weapon. President Obama has been crystal clear about this. And as we've repeatedly made clear, the window for a diplomatic solution simply cannot, by definition, remain open forever. But it is open today.
A natural disaster has been declared in New South Wales in Australia after heavy rain brought devastating floods. Many homes have been destroyed and homes have been evacuated on the south coast because of fears that debris is contaminated by asbestos. A cyclone ripped through the town of Kiama on Sunday, where an asbestos exclusion zone has been set up. Thousands of Palestinians have marched on the West Bank today at the funeral of a Palestinian prisoner who died in an Israeli jail. The death of 30-year-old Arafat Jaradat on Saturday has raised tension in the occupied territory after repeated clashes between stone throwers and Israeli soldiers in recent days. And 15 Russian sailors charged with illegally taking weapons into Nigeria last year have been granted bail by a Lagos court and released until a hearing in early April. Nigerian authorities intercepted a ship and arrested its Russian crew on the 23rd of October after they found several guns and around 8,000 rounds of ammunition on board. That's the latest news at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. It's just approaching 18:06 here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, ask any Western military or political leader about Afghanistan, and they will repeat a mantra that has become as familiar as it is reassuring. When NATO combat troops leave next year, they will hand over responsibility to Afghan police and security forces that have been rigorously trained over the past few years. Afghanistan security will be safe in their hands. They are trusted by the population and willing and able to take on the Taliban. It's familiar, it's reassuring, and as a new film devastatingly demonstrates, it's complete nonsense. Here's Ben Anderson.
It's not just that it was for nothing, it was almost worse than nothing, because we're introducing a predatory force who are, you know, behaving so monstrously in the south that I can absolutely see southern Pashtuns in Afghanistan welcoming a return of the Taliban, because they will see them as the good and just Muslims who don't tax them at checkpoints, don't rob them, don't kidnap them, don't abduct and rape their children. You know, it's exactly the same sort of conditions that existed in the mid-90s that meant the Taliban swept to power so easily.
When we talk to politicians on both sides of the Atlantic about Afghanistan, they say, well, look, you know, it's, yes, it's been difficult and there's been some problems, but we had to go in after September the 11th. We had to get rid of the Taliban. You know, we are training the Afghan security forces. We're training the police. We're going to leave Afghanistan in a better place than it was before. It's not going to be, you know, like other times where people have gone in and then left Afghanistan broken. I mean, this just highlights the fact that, you know, what they're saying is nonsense. Do you think they realise it's nonsense and are saying it, or do you think they just don't understand?
I've actually seen, I saw a briefing of the US and British ambassadors in Sangin, and I couldn't believe what wasn't being said in this briefing. I mean, I almost wanted to interrupt and speak up, because it was such a rosy picture when I knew what the reality was just 1 mile down the road. Most people are saying there's a chance of civil war when we leave. I think the civil war's already started. You know, the Taliban are no longer targeting us. They know we're on our way out. I mean, in Sangin, there are 500 US Marines there. They've withdrawn to the main base, which they almost never leave. Just two teams of 18 Marines go out to advise the Afghan police and army occasionally. So the Taliban are targeting the Afghan army and police and killing them in hundreds. So the civil war has already started.
That was Ben Anderson, whose new film on Afghanistan, Mission Accomplished, that's with a question mark, airs on the BBC in the UK tonight and throughout the world all this week. And you can hear more of that interview with Ben on the Monocle Weekly with me and Andrew Tuck on monocle.com. Robert Fox, a veteran defence correspondent and a man who has himself spent much time in Afghanistan and indeed in Sanjin province, joins us in the studio now. Robert, does this surprise you?
No, it doesn't. I think it's a bit extreme to say that the civil war has already started. That's a bit of a high estimate, because if Ben Anderson really believes that, then it never really ended. And I think that is part of the story. In a way, there's a very nasty streak to this stuff, which I entirely believe of what he's saying about the police. I don't think it's universally so, but I think it is, particularly in parts of Helmand and other places, that they're part of patronage, they're part of a mafia system. Sometimes some of them will go over to so-called Taliban groups. Some will fight them. But I think that we've been misled by the general label of the Taliban. It's not a unified army. But I think that this is good old-fashioned brigandage and banditry with a very new face, very unpleasant one.
Now, when we spoke to Ben, he was pretty depressed about the whole thing, found it difficult to find any rays of hope within the Afghan security forces and police forces. When you've seen them in action, do you think there are any rays of hope, any sort of good areas where the training's been good and where actually there's a solid police force that really wants to do the job that is expected of them?
Well, curiously, one of the most successful has been where the outsiders haven't been around. And it's in Bamyan province, right up under the Hindu Kush. Bamyan is very largely a Hazara. They have a very distinct Mongol features. They're Shia. And, of course, they're being picked on and murdered wholesale inside Pakistan, particularly around Quetta at the moment. The Taliban themselves were responsible for a mini genocide. So there's no point in being sentimental about the Taliban, which a lot of reporters are. They killed 30,000, 40,000 of them in 1 year in the late 1990s. In Bamyan, to cut to the chase, there is a remarkable female governor, the only female governor, Habiba Surabi. She's a doctor. She believes in literacy. And she had a wonderful scheme called 2+1. Every literate person in public service must help train two illiterates. Got a police force of over 80% literacy, which is turning the under 20% are illiterate, well under 20%. You're lucky if in the rest of Afghanistan, probably with the exception of Kabul and Herat, if they're over 20%. They have made a difference. But what we have to ask ourselves is how much of a difference have they made without the direct help of the foreigners? The Aga Khan's charity, which is very local, is particularly helpful there. No, I think I agree with Ben Anderson in this. If it's a headline, I think they've completely misread the situation.
Is there a way that what happened in Bamyan can be repeated elsewhere?
No, because they're beleaguered there. I mean, still the outlying provinces, the districts in the districts, there are six, will be cut off by snow. And I think that that's where Ben does have a real note of warning in that things could just fragment, that we'll have very strong cities. Kabul, I think, is going to be fought over. Herat is very much under Iranian influence, and it has a commerce of its own. But I think the shocking thing is that where this the enormous power of the narco economy leads to a certain kind of anarchy to a certain level. And don't believe the Taliban don't have a dog in this fight, because they have a very large dog in this fight, because they've manipulated the narco trade altogether.
When you hear US and UK military and political leaders talking about, you know, trying to paint a picture that's a bit more upbeat and saying, okay, there are some problems, but, you know, on the whole, what we've done there is a good thing, and these forces are going to be okay, and they'll be able to do a decent job. Do you think they genuinely believe that, or do they just think, well, look, this is the line and we're sticking to it?
I think that's a very, very difficult question. Because they don't use the language that you and I do, because that's why they don't understand the world of journalism. They don't understand communication. I can't really work out in my mind when you get a British general, say, returning, as one did a few months ago, saying, oh, attacks are 10% down here, 5% down there, and it's turning into that, this and that. They don't speak the languages. I don't speak even the predominant Dari or Pashtun. So you don't see into the minds of these people. I think, yes, there has been an awful lot of willful self-deception. But I don't think things are going to go back to where they were because of one or two very simple things. And one of the simplest things is the enormous prevalence of the mobile phone. You get 80% coverage of the mobile phone. That is why, to the new generation, if they could possibly get out of it, they don't want to be like their fathers, where anarchy in the 1990s condemned them to the darkness of illiteracy. That's why a lot of people want illiteracy, literacy, learning, schools. And even some so-called Taliban elements, even around the Sangin Valley, in the upper Sangin Valley, are prepared to open schools and even have girls go to, of course, separate girls' schools.
And just finally, you know, we've got 18 months or a little bit more until the last combat troops leave. Obviously, there will still be other Western forces there. Do you think that there is progress that can still be made to try and train up the better elements within the Afghan security forces before the West leaves?
I think that's the key to it. I think that they will have to cadreize. They can't do it across the piece. I would suspect for what they intended to do, the Afghan national forces of police with the army at 350,000 plus are far too big. It's largely, you're right, largely uneducated police force. It's very susceptible to local pressures of all kinds. They are part of the banditry. They're not a separate bandit gang, and that's the problem. But I do hope there's some serious recalibration. I fear there's not, because what the British and the Americans will say, let's get out of here, at least with as much of our name intact as possible, which is what happened disastrously in Iraq only a few years ago.
Robert, thanks. Robert Fox, we'll leave that there. Thank you very much for coming in. Coming up from one Fox to another, Pim Fox of Bloomberg News brings us up to date on the week's big events in North America.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we welcome the wonderful villagers into our own little world for a live Midori House session. We hear some wonderful stuff from the current season of Kowloon's Cantonese opera, get tech savvy in San Francisco, and Ossian Ward teaches us how to review art.
They've obviously thought, here's the message we want to get across. He was a well-educated, serious, ambitious artist. He wasn't just a chancer.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 1817 here in London, 1317 in New York City, which is where we head now. The voice of Pim Fox will be well known to viewers on Bloomberg TV and listeners to Bloomberg Radio. When it comes to the world of finance, there are a few commentators who can match Pim for style or, of course, substance. Every Monday and Friday on The Briefing here on Monocle 24, Pim will be giving us a rundown of the big business stories of the day in his own inimitable style. And we thought we'd kick off this series with a broader discussion here on Midori House, concentrating on the biggest business issues of the week. I caught up with Pim just before we went on air. And what did he believe the big story of the week was?
Sequestration. That's where the U.S. government literally stops spending money on Friday. Like, literally, just chop. I mean, you're talking about sending home people that are in air traffic control towers. You're talking about, people that work at the border and customs. Yeah.
But the whole idea of this, Pim, was that they would make cuts so severe that they would have to come up with a better deal beforehand. And yet it seems that instead everyone's going, well, you know, these cuts maybe aren't too bad.
Yeah, and exactly. You know, it's like that thing, you know, where I don't know if you have a partner or something or a family member, you know, you say, okay, we're going to agree to disagree. Here, no, this is, we're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So who's likely to blink first?
I don't think anybody really knows. I really think that you've got a situation now where people are just kind of like, I don't know. I don't know what's going to go on. I mean, they're going to try to cobble together something. But, I mean, you've got Republicans, which are big proponents of defense spending, right? Mm. And just to put that number into context, it's, you know, that the United States every year spends $700 billion on defense. That's just like what we know about. And that is more, that is, no, and because, I mean, you know, they got these programs that go on until, you know, the next 20, 30 years. But, I mean, $700 billion a year, that's the annual tab. And that is more than the combined military budget of every other nation on the planet.
So it's the sort of thing that suggests that there's room to make a few cuts there.
Well, I mean, Republicans
have been loath to suggest this in the past, but there's some indications they might be willing to consider something this time round.
Listen, I think the way you got to look at this is you have to look at it through the lens of what these people think are going to get them votes. That's really what this is about. Because, I mean, as you just said, right, you'd think that there'd be some place, if this was such the biggest deal, I mean, we're talking about cuts, what is it, $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion, right? I mean, some number, some huge, but this is over a decade. Does anybody really believe that the agreement that is reached, let's say even if we did it today, is going to stick for a decade? No one believes that, right? I mean, you know, he's not even going to be president in 4 years, for heaven's sakes. So, you know, to have these long-range plans, it would be like you saying, you know, when you get home and lay out some plan and say, well, you know, I really don't think over the next 15 years we should ever really think about replacing a piece of furniture. Well, maybe right now it seems great because everything looks spanking new. But, I mean, the reality is, you know, in 5 years you might not even be living there. So I think this is about politics. This, you know, politics means voting. And, everybody's got a little pet project that they want to keep going on. And if you happen to be a senator or a congressman from a location that's got big government contracts for military aircraft, it's a tough vote.
It is indeed. How does this sort of constant negotiating and talking and threats and so on, and it's been going on for many, many months now in various different guises.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how does it affect businesses on a day-to-day level in the US? I mean, can they just pretty much ignore what happens, or is it really actually that sort of instability, that sort of uncertainty?
Right, right, that really uncertainty word thing that happens, right? You need that. It's like getting the Alka-Seltzer for the sequester. You now need something else for the uncertainty. But they've got stuff for that, right? I mean, you can take, I don't know, what is it, Zoloft or Prozac or Wellbutrin or, you know, whatever. I mean,
well, what's like, the equivalent, you know, then, the business equivalent then,
yeah,
of Prozac?
I mean, I think the business equivalent is, you know, you basically don't hire people unless you absolutely positively have to in order to keep the customer happy, hence the fabulous level of customer service that I know Tyler Brulé has always talked about when he comes to the United States, specifically when he travels on U.S. air flag carriers, which is true.
Yes, quite.
So, I mean, think about it. We've got results from companies like Macy's. They're going to be reporting their results. And all anybody, I think, really looks at is says, look, how much does gasoline cost? What are your taxes? And how much do people have left over at the end of their pay period? And if you've got more, people cheer. If you've got less, people moan. And that's the attitude of business now, I think. It's just leave me alone. I'll do what I have to do. But I think that business is kind of inured to this back and forth that goes on in Washington. They've come to expect it. It's like a spectator sport. They turn on cable news and it's there.
So is it almost that they price this in? They just expect now this uncertainty and this instability and say, well, we'll just have to deal with that and, you know, and that's that.
I mean, I don't want to say it's hypocritical, but it's almost this schizoid attitude, which is on the one hand, you know, you bemoan the quality of elected officials and you really have debate over how much should be spent on things like health care and Social Security and defense and education. But on the other hand, if you happen to do business with the government or you've got a contract with the government or your customer who makes their money is the one that has the contract with the government, don't touch that. Right. So it's on the one hand, there's no reason why they need to build a bridge to nowhere. Well, you know, if the bridge to nowhere happens to be in your backyard, that's not nowhere.
No, that's creating a lot of jobs.
And yeah, right. There you go. And you have a conflict. I mean, you know, I don't want to get, you know, too heavy on this with you. But I mean, you know, this is like a major cyclical and secular change. Right. I mean, you guys went in the UK. I mean, listen, Lord knows you need coal. Right. I mean, it's a big industry. Mm. We love it. But really, does anybody really look around and say, gee, I want to scrape and save in order to send my kids to school so they can go down into a coal mine? Not really. I mean,
no, but it provided an awful lot of jobs. And yeah, it created a number of very big communities, which are in trouble now.
Exactly. And so, you know, you live on with these kinds of consequences for generations, because what are you going to do? You're going to turn all of the sons and daughters of all these people instantly into engineers that are going to make iPads? I mean, it's a gray area, but I think whether it is a transformation in terms of the way people view work or the way they view accumulation of wealth. I mean, you know, think about it. We have a more divided nation in terms of wealth now than we have had, I think it's since like 1982. And what I mean by that is like the top 1% of the population in terms of numbers of people take home more than 10% of whatever the country produces. And it also shows up in tax figures, right? I mean, 50% of the population of the United States do not pay income tax. Do not pay any. They pay sales tax, they pay gasoline tax, all this stuff, property tax. But I mean, when you think about it, you go, whoa, that's you know, that's like balancing an elephant on a peanut. And so you end up with all of these very bizarre unintended consequences, right? You know, you get lobby groups. Anyway, I don't need to bore you with all this, but I mean, you know, it shakes out in what's going to happen this week. Yeah, I mean, there's a much bigger picture, and so I think that the businesses, to go back to your original point, the businesses say, look, I can't comprehend this big picture thing. I'm sorry, I can't sort this out. I just want to know, are you going to buy my product, or you know, do you like my new dresses at Macy's or Target or TJX or Limited, right? Do you like my new underwear? I mean, that's the big thing. So that's, I think, the state of business right now.
And that was Pim Fox of Bloomberg TV. And don't forget, you can hear Pim every Monday and Friday on The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Now, do you want to buy a house? We're going to meet an estate agent with a difference right after this. From building homes in Algeria to implementing some of the country's harshest austerity measures in history, Portugal is trying everything and anything to dig itself out of recession. New figures show it's not really working. The government last week forecasted the economy would contract by around 2% this year, double the initial estimate. Now the Secretary of State for Tourism, Adolfo Mesquita Nunes, is heading a new and somewhat unlikely plan to invigorate the ailing economy, encouraging foreigners to buy a second home in Portugal. Monocle's associate business editor Adrian Craddock asked Mr. Mesquita Nunes about how the plan would work and why the UK is its main target.
British people are usual buyers of second homes, and we host so many British as tourists that we want to go to the second stage. You do not only you come for tourism, but you also come to buy a home. So you are a quite strong market for Portugal. You know us well already. You like to be in Portugal for tourism, so why not to buy a second home when you are buying it in other countries?
And when it comes to second homes and countries that have been very successful in attracting people to buy second homes in their country, Spain is often brought up. I mean, are you taking lessons from Spain in this regard? I mean, what do you think you can learn from that model and implement it into Portugal?
Although we are neighbours and we have the same kind of climate, we have diversity between Portugal and Spain. We didn't have such a huge pressure on the real estate, so we have a very good quality offer in real estate, in tourism equipments, and so we are somehow different than Spain. The lesson is that you should resist to the pressure of the real estate interests, and that's one lesson that we took and we are now hoping to take profit for.
When people buy homes abroad, one of the very important parts of buying a home is securing financing. And perhaps this has put a few people off buying a home in Portugal because there is this perception that it may be difficult or the banks are not strong enough in Portugal to secure funding for a second home. How do you respond to that?
I must say that the Portuguese banking system is quite strong now. During the assistance program, one of the main issues of the program was to capitalize the banks, and they are now capitalized in a quite high level, so they can be compared to any other banking in Northern Europe. So it is a safe banking system that is willing to cooperate with Portuguese government in this program, provided that you want to buy a home and you are a safe buyer. I don't think that there would be any problem in getting the credit you need or the funding you need to buy it.
Because of Portugal's economic problems at the moment, it seems like perhaps the banks have an image problem. Would you agree with that? I mean, it seems like people abroad have this perception that it may be difficult.
The banking was never one of the biggest problems in Portugal, even during the crisis. That is more connected to other problems in other economies than the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. So I would say that if there is that perception is wrong. And I must tell you that our safety, our climate, our natural resources, they are not under any external program. They are quite there for people to enjoy it. And I don't think there is any fear about Portugal or even the Portuguese economy that should prevent people to buy homes in Portugal.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask about is it seems like tourism is becoming a very important part of bringing around recovery in Portugal. Although it seems in the press that austerity still seems to be the main issue. Your government has stuck by austerity for a long time. Reports out this month show that the economy has not recovered as quickly as was first hoped. How do you respond to that? I mean, it's all well and good pushing tourism, but do you think that a change needs to come in this other important area as well?
Portuguese government is dealing with the crisis in a quite successful way, I must say. Of course, we have the problems that you are mentioning, but we are correcting all the problems that made us face the crisis. I'm sure that with the new developments on Europe, that we will find a way to compensate the austerity that we need with the growth that we hope to get. So, yes, the austerity was in the first period of time a word that was in everybody's minds because we needed to correct our disadjustments. And now that we made that work, it's time to get a growth mood. So growth, it will be the word to replace austerity.
I mean, you said there that now that you've made it work, is that exaggerating in some way? I mean, because I feel like there are still considerable problems in the country.
Let me explain. We have huge problems on our deficit, intern, and with the trade deficit. We are correcting those adjustments. So now that we are correcting those problems, we can look back to the real economy and to make it grow because we are now having the conditions to do that. We are increasing our exports in a very considerable and sustainable way. We are correcting our deficit problems. So, yes, we are now in condition to say to Europe, now it's time to grow. But we needed to pass to those phases before to say it now loud and clear that Portugal is on its path.
That was a rather optimistic Portuguese tourism minister, Adolfo Mesquita Nunes, speaking to a slightly more cynical associate business editor, Adrian Craddock. Coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, we welcome author and journalist Rory Carroll into the studio to talk about his new book, Comandante, about life under Hugo Chavez. And our news editor, Tom Edwards, finds out about the changes afoot in Thailand's toiletry system. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Initial exit polls show Italy's centre-left taking a strong lead in the country's lower house of parliament, with one analyst saying a poor result by outgoing Prime Minister Mario Monti is the biggest surprise of the day. Agriculture ministers from across the EU have been meeting in Brussels to discuss meat labelling as the horse meat scandal continues to grow across the continent. The Vatican has announced that Pope Benedict has changed Catholic law to allow a successor to be elected early. And 15 Russian sailors charged with illegally taking weapons into Nigeria last year have been granted bail by a Lagos court and released until a hearing in early April. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
1934 in Paris, 1834 here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, one of the remaining political superstars of Latin America, Hugo Chavez, remains just about at the helm of Venezuela, continually re-elected despite, argues our next guest, the crumbling of his nation. Both admired and reviled in equal measure, his track record boasts the seizure of control of the lucrative Venezuelan oil industry, the imprisonment of political opponents, and of course, a daily primetime show on the airwaves with his television programme, Hello President, among other highlights. Rory Carroll, Guardian Chief Correspondent for South America and author of Comandante, joins us now to understand better the enduring success of Hugo Chavez. Rory, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to start by quoting from Gabriel Garcia Marquez in the prologue to your book. He spends a bit of time with Chavez on a plane. He writes this big profile of him, fairly glowing, you know, to a certain extent. But he ends by saying he feels that he'd been talking to two opposing men, one who had an opportunity to save his country and the other who could pass into the history books as just another despot. You then, obviously, through the course of the book, look at both sides of those. By the time you get to the end, do you work out which one Chavez is, or is he both?
Yes, I do work out which, in my opinion, he's very much the illusionist. There were occasional despotic flashes in terms of the odd, you know, jailing of opponents, taking over pretty much every institution in the state. But he was never a classic despot. He was democratically elected. He won elections. So really, for me, the most fascinating thing about Chavez is the fact that he was an illusionist, in that he managed to preside over the crumbling of a country through mismanagement, incompetence, and yet he retained popularity. He retained this messianic appeal. And in that sense, Gabriel Garcia Marquez had this kind of pure clairvoyance in anticipating this.
And when you look at the way that most of the media, most of the world considers Chavez, do you think there's a danger that we're not quite nuanced enough, that it's, you know, he's either, you know, to some on the left, a hero, or to others, a despot?
Completely. I think this. I've always been astonished when I would leave Venezuela and go to Europe or China and find people's reactions were just so comical to me, because you would either hear from the left that Chavez was this amazing champion of the poor who had reinvented the wheel, or from the right, people would just, you know, consider that he was some sort of Stalinist who had created a wasteland in his country, and that neither version was true.
The Chavez project is very much obviously sort of wrapped up in the man himself. Right now, I mean, he's back in Venezuela now, and you know, after this long illness of his treatment for cancer in Cuba. But I mean, who knows how long he will still be with us? Those that might replace him certainly don't have the same charisma and the same leadership skills, do they?
No. Certainly his designated heir is Nicolas Maduro, who is a former bus driver turned foreign minister, turned heir apparent, has not an ounce of charisma. I mean, he walks into a room and really, you know, you meet him and there's nothing, there's little there. That said, he will inherit a big infrastructure of control of the state, of the armed forces, and a state media empire, which will help him a lot. But there is concern that because he will lack Chavez's charisma and Chavez's great communication with skills, that Maduro may rely a bit more on repression, more so than Chavez ever did.
And is there also a danger that Maduro won't necessarily actually always be in charge? There are other competing factions, you know, within the government, aren't there?
Yes, and Chavez was always very skilled at playing these factions off against each other. He was the glue that kept them together. There was, for instance, the military faction, which in the end entailed basically a bunch of kleptocratic generals and colonels who would make deals with Colombian drug dealers for trafficking cocaine. But Chavez turned a blind eye to their deals in return for their loyalty. You had left-wing civilian ideologues, quasi-Marxists or full-fledged Marxists, and so forth. And so now Maduro will really struggle, lacking Chavez's charisma and history, he will struggle to keep them together.
If Chavez is in a reflective mood at the moment and looking back on what he's done in his years in power, Do you think he can honestly point to successes and say, actually, I feel like I've achieved something here. I've changed my country. I've influenced Latin America.
He himself, privately, never publicly, has been quite critical of the revolution's failures in terms of mismanagement and corruption. For instance, his own private elevator in the palace, a minister, I learned, leaks from the rain. And this is representative of the wider decay and dilapidation of the country in terms of this thing's crumbling. So I think Chavez has now, again, also privately, he's looked out abroad, looking to Latin America generally, and, you know, the growth of pride and weight of Brazil, Ecuador, and the greatest self-confidence of these countries now. And he considers this as one of his greatest legacies in Latin America.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Brazil. I mean, some people would argue that actually, you know, he had a rival when it comes to the left and Latin America in Lula da Silva, who was still considered, you know, pretty left wing, but practiced a more, you know, perhaps sort of centre leftish sort of, I'm willing to sort of make some compromises form of social democracy.
Yes, and ultimately Chavez lost that battle. There was this contest for primacy between them, and the fact that Brazil basically built a sustainable model of poverty alleviation and is now a heavyweight internationally, whereas Venezuela is almost forgotten in many ways, except for the drama of Hugo Chavez's rule. But as a player, politically and economically, it no longer matters as much. So I think it's clear that that Chavez lost that, and that's is symptomatic of the wider failures.
As a journalist, how have you found covering Chavez? I mean, if you've been watching every Sunday, watching A La Presidente and seeing what he's up to, how do you sort of go about covering this man?
It was fascinating as a journalistic enterprise. A lot of it, though, would be entail watching television because he was almost always on TV, and this would be live, and amazing things would happen while he was on TV. He could mobilize troops to the Colombian border. He could nationalize an industry. You just never knew quite what happened.
A very strange form of transparency.
Yes, it was basically ruled by television, which is why I was quite keen to get on his show or to see it firsthand. And I did one time. And that was just amazing to see the show and then suddenly to become part of it, because he ended up using me as a prop, if you like, on his show. And that was his way. You know, he would just look for opportunities to create diversions and create a circus in a way. And I mean, I had my own role as an animal in his Colosseum.
Did you find that quite difficult?
Well, I found it. Yeah, I guess I did. I found it was fascinating. I mean, he invited me to ask a question on his show as a "Hola, Rory Carroll del Guardian," you know, tell us, what is your question? So I asked him a question about basically why he was centralizing power in the presidency, and he loathed the question. He hated it, and so he basically poured a bucket of rhetorical excrement over my head it went on for ages, or maybe 30 minutes or so.
Question you've got to ask, though.
It was, because there was a particular moment in time why that was the question to ask. But the interesting thing is, I mean, he used me in a way as a punching bag for his show, and it made for good television because it was, you know, I was then the villain, the stand-in villain. But at the end of the show, when it ended, he shook my hand, he was perfectly civil, and, you know, and he was fine. And it was understood that really this was just a show and I had my role in it.
Rory Carroll, thank you very much indeed. The book is Comandante, Inside Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. You're listening to Midori House after this. Toilets, apparently.
Inspiration comes from finding new ventures that combine traditions with an original contemporary approach, especially when it comes to food. Monocle Films visits Toronto, Lisbon and Thessaloniki to discover some sweet recipes for success. Nadege, along with her small but dedicated crew of pastry chefs, create every morsel on site in a large open kitchen connected to the main dining area. It's here that they balance flavour with colour, texture with geometry, and creativity with shelf appeal. Taste with your eyes on monocle.com.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House. Now we're paying a rare visit to the realm of the porcelain throne. And there are few issues that are guaranteed to flush out dissenting voices, quite like government plans relating to toilets. In Thailand, the public health ministry has split the population with its bid to replace the country's traditional public squat toilets with modern seated facilities, all within 3 years. So will this bold new vision swirl away down the pan, or will the government manage to beat the current system and roll out its plan? Well, our news editor Tom Edwards sought the answers to those questions from Jack Sim, founder of the World Toilet Organization, who spoke to us at his convenience.
The Thailand authority seems to have want to change all the squat toilets into seat toilets immediately overnight. I think that when you do that, there is a transition period for those who have been habitually squatting all the time and not used to sitting. So what would happen would be that people would like to sit, but those who like to squat would have nowhere to squat. So they probably would squat over the seat cover and you will see footprints on it. And this transition period will last over some years until people get into the habit of sitting. The best way is to have at least one squat pan so that they have the option of squatting for those who can't change the habit immediately.
And tell me, Jack, what is the things that fans of the squat toilet really strongly dislike then about the seated toilets? What are their main objections? And what do you think that the government could try to do to maybe convince them to change their minds?
Well, first of all, the squat position is the most natural position since early man time. So when we were cavemen, it's a squatting, and we are designed to squat so that we would fertilize the soil so the soil will be rich. And later on, when we use the toilet, the squatting position continues to be very nice because it moves our bowels completely. Whereas if you are sitting, you do not empty your bowels totally in one go. So you might have to stand up and then sit down again to release the rest of your download. The other benefit, obviously, is that you do not have contact with the toilet seat cover, which somebody else has sat on it earlier. So my advice is that people, especially travelers, should carry some toilet seat covers in their handbag or wallet so that in case the seat cover is dirty, they could just lay it over and be safe.
How frequent is it, do you think, that we see these kind of problems around the world with governments struggling to kind of flush out the last bits of support for making these kind of changes?
I think we are having a globalized world. So with the advent of budget airline, you have all kinds of people from different cultural backgrounds traveling to one another places. So first of all, you need a lot of seat toilet for those who are visiting your country, like in Thailand that predominantly was squat toilet. And so the globalization means that you also need some squat toilet because there could be people from China and other ASEAN regions visiting Thailand and they are used to squatting. So I would imagine that having the both options is very good. And of course, if you have both options, you have to put the label outside the cubicle so they know that this is a squat toilet and this is a seat toilet, so they wouldn't be waiting at the wrong door.
And just to sort of balance out the discussion somewhat, I guess one of the other problems identified in Thailand, a lot from public opinion polls, is that squat toilets are actually very bad in terms of people's joints because of their forcing them to squat, particularly for elderly people, people with joint problems. That's another problem, isn't it, with the squat toilet?
Well, it's true because elderly doesn't have the muscle to lift up, and so you have to put grab bars and other kind of support. So on the one hand, an aging population would be better off with the seat toilet. And the other thing is that a seat toilet is also a sense of high class elegance. So if you take these two factors into consideration and you look at Japan, Japan has been a squat culture for a long time, and they have been changing very rapidly into seat toilets. Of course, if you are going in the big city, most of the toilets are now seated, but they do have the squat option, because in the countryside, the habit is still largely squat. So of course, when the people come from the outside into the city, you don't want them to change their habit, and you can give them the option of at least one squat toilet inside the whole row of cubicles.
And Jack, just finally, I just wondered, in terms of the costs involved with these kind of programs, clearly squat toilets are much cheaper. They're also easier to maintain. Isn't that a real factor? One of the reasons that people are poo-pooing seated toilets is because they're so expensive to install and maintain.
That's true. But the cost is just a one-time cost for the hardware. So the cost difference is not very major, but the cleaning, you have more surfaces to clean, and also the training of the cleaner would be important. The other thing is also that if you have a wall-hung seat toilet, then you have some space at the bottom for the free floor to clean and to mop. But if you have a pedestal one, then again you have more edges, and that may collect some smell. So that means the cleaner has to be also trained to clean the seat toilet.
That was Jack Sim of the World Toilet Organization talking to our news editor Tom Edwards shortly before we came on air. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, whether it's Britain, whether it's the US, whether it's Scandinavia, whether it's India, this year's Oscar ceremony seems to have been especially good for, well, pretty much everyone. A scan of the international press reveals how various nations are reclaiming the success at the Oscars as their own. Argo's Best Picture win was apparently a triumph for Canada. The Brit celebrated Daniel Day-Lewis's Best Actor turn, while by ending his acceptance speech with Namaste, a greeting from the Indian subcontinent, Ang Lee's own victory was apparently celebrated by India's own fans as their own. Now, Elna Nykänen Andersson, our correspondent in Stockholm, had this take on Sweden's success.
So this year for Sweden was very good at the Oscars. We got, I say we, it's nice to include yourself. The Swedes got three statues, Malik Bendjelloul for the best documentary, Searching for Sugar Man, and then Paul Ottosson and Per Hallberg, who shared the Best Sound Editing Prize for their work on Zero Dark Thirty and Skyfall. And it's pretty unusual that a prize is shared, but it was pretty suitable this year, because these guys are not only working with the same thing, they also share the same hairstyle, which is kind of a half-long blonde Viking hairstyle, I'd say. Searching for Sugar Man has won loads of other prizes before, a BAFTA, for instance. And it's a very, very nice, moving story about Sixto Rodriguez, this musician who was kind of forgotten but had this career in South Africa that he didn't even know about himself, that he was so popular there. And it's the first sort of Swedish film that has won since the 80s, when Ingmar Bergman won with Fanny and Alexander.
That was Elna Nykänen Andersson, our correspondent in Stockholm. I love the fact that she referred to it as we. Now, two other people who might use that word are Dave McGinn, arts and entertainment reporter for Toronto's Globe and Mail, and Stephen Bodson, our man in Chile. They're both here to fly the flag for their respective host nations. Dave, should you be happy about this, about Argo? I mean, it's an American film. I watched it. Apparently, it was all the CIA.
Well, Ken Taylor said that he's satisfied with the shout-out he got last night, so I guess we all kind of have to be, although...
And Ken Taylor is the former ambassador, the Canadian ambassador.
Yes, he is Canada's former ambassador in Iran, who is portrayed in the movie, and who Jimmy Carter said on CNN just last week deserves much more of the credit than he actually gets in the movie. And it would have been nice if Ben Affleck had named him in his speech, but we got a blanket shout out to Canada, and that seemed to have satisfied him.
Okay, and so you're happy with that. Do you many Canadians then claim this victory as one for Canada?
I think most people are actually probably more happy with the success of Life of Pi because it was such a great Canadian novel.
Ah, really? Well, okay, you mentioned Life of Pi. Steve Bodson is in Santiago. I mean, you're going to be claiming Life of Pi as well because Claudio Miranda won Best Cinematography, and he's from your neck of the woods.
As a Canadian in Chile, I get to be doubly proud. good to hear from you today. It certainly showed up in the newspaper. Got some mentions here, but at the same time, people here do recognize that he was born in Chile in 1965, but left the country within a year to go live in the U.S. and hasn't apparently lived here since. So they know well enough to not take too much credit for his success.
Now there was some sort of disappointing news as well for Chile, wasn't there, Stephen? Because Pablo Larraín's film No lost out in the best foreign language film. Is there much disappointment or that, or was it kind of expected?
When he was first nominated, told the press that he didn't have much hopes of winning against the eventual winner, Amor. I don't think that people are hugely disappointed. In fact, people are really excited because this is the first time that a film made in Chile actually got nominated for any Academy Awards. So people are pretty happy with that. This is an industry that's been around for a century and has gotten very little international recognition.
Indeed. Dave, are Canadians a little bit wary about trying to celebrate this too much in that, you know, it wasn't a Canadian-produced film and, you know, perhaps there's a sense that, well, maybe we should just, you know, hold on until there's something really to celebrate?
For Life of Pi, you mean?
No, I meant for Argo. But you're claiming Life of Pi as well, I guess.
I feel like the feeling here is that Americans will always sort of trumpet their own achievements and minimize anyone else's, even in what was originally called the Canadian caper. So I don't think there's too much surprise. I think everyone would have liked maybe more credit than the Canadians that were involved in it have been given. But, it's all over now, and what can you do?
Indeed, what can you do? But at least there's something to celebrate for both Chile and Canada and, of course, Sweden. Dave McGinn, arts and entertainment reporter for Globe and Mail, and Stephen Bodson, our man in Chile in Santiago. Thank you both indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're almost at the very end of the show. Before we go, I want to welcome to the studio Emily Aylett. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. Now, you are here to tell us all about the Pacific Shift, which is making its debut tonight in just over an hour.
Yeah, the debut is tonight, the Pacific Shift. Monocle's live playlist is expanding into the evening. So tonight is the first Pacific Shift, which sees much more of Monocle's live music playlist from around the world. And we'll also be getting lots of news and some clips of the highlights from today's shows as
well. So basically the idea is that this will run from 2000 hours up until the start of the Monocle Daily at 2200 to give a bit more of a bridge between Midori and the Monocle Daily.
Absolutely, and we've got Emma Nelson, who's presenting tonight with Andrew Miller, coming to the studio to tell us what she's doing as well tonight, so that'll be good.
Excellent. So some music, a bit of a recap for the day, and a look ahead to the Monocle Daily.
Absolutely, bit of a warm-up.
Excellent, good. Emily, we look forward to tuning into that. That is coming up in an hour's time. That's all for Midori House for today. Thank you very much to our producer, Aled John, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager, Alex Funnel. Next up, before Emily, it's Culture with Rob Bound. He'll be heading to the latest Roy Lichtenstein retrospective here in London. And Time Out's Ossian Ward will explain what an art critic looks for when reviewing an exhibition.
They've obviously thought, here's the message we want to get across. He was a well-educated, serious, ambitious artist. He wasn't just a chancer.
That's Rob's Culture Show coming up after this. Then Emily will be here with the Pacific Shift, and then it's the Monocle Daily. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.